hbpodcraft.com.
Get out of this room.
And that was a short clip from the film Die, Monster, Die, an adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Color Out of Space. And we're here to discuss it on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Fife.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and this is our exclusive patron bonus content for the month of April.
We've talked about Lovecraft film adaptations in general in the past, but folks have multiple times asked us to maybe drill in on specific films, so we are doing that.
Yeah.
I was interested in this movie, Die, Monster, Die, because it's one of the earliest adaptations of Lovecraft's work for film, but it also comes up a lot in conversation when we're talking about Lovecraft films, but I've actually never seen it before. Had you?
I thought I had seen it, but I realized I only saw the end of it.
I should say it's referenced a lot in conversation. Actually, nobody has ever said like, hey man, if you really want to be scared, have I got the movie for you?
Nobody's going to say that.
It's like Silence of the Lambs, but all the best parts of On Golden Pond put together into a sweet little horror package. It's not that. It just seems like a lot of people have seen it. There are a couple of bands called Die, Monster, Die. There's a punk band. I think there was an older rock band.
What?
And there's a Misfits song with that title from the later non-Danzig incarnation of the band. So, you know, I'm intrigued. What is this thing?
Die, Monster, Die was released in 1965, but it also had the title Monster of Terror.
I love that title. It's a little redundant. It's like chef of cooking, prostitute of sex.
There was no monster of joy.
Yeah, there's exactly. But I can't help it. Every time I see this title, it reminds me of The Simpsons. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but there's a real famous Simpsons quote or episode early on when Sideshow Bob was at a parole hearing.
Yeah.
And they were saying, if we let you out of jail, are you just going to try and kill Bart Simpson again? And he's going, no. And the lawyer says,
well, what about that tattoo on your chest? Doesn't it say die, Bart, die?
No, that's German for the Bart, the.
No one who speaks German could be an evil man.
Parole granted.
Every time I see this title, I'm thinking the monster, the.
It stars Boris Karloff, was directed by Daniel Haller. Haller also directed the Dunwich Horror, the one with Dean Stockwell, which we've talked about also on our show. Yeah. But he mostly did a lot of TV direction, most notably 2 episodes of Manimal.
Oh, now I'm starstruck. Did he try to work Lovecraft into this episode? Do you know which ones he did? Did he do a Lovecraft Manimal episode?
I don't remember off the top of my head, no. Which one?
Pickman's Manimal, maybe?
That's the one. Yes, you got it.
Pickman disappears. It's a sequel to that story.
Uh-huh.
They got to get Manimal on the case because he can infiltrate. He just starts turning into a dog and then stops like halfway through. Looks like a ghoul. So he can infiltrate the tunnels and try and find Pickman.
Could Manimal stop in between transformations and be like a half man, half animal?
The sad thing about that show being canceled is we'll never know. But I imagine he has all sorts of powers that we didn't find out about.
Yeah, there's been a lot of bad things that have happened in human history, and I gotta say that the cancellation of Manimal ranks right up there.
Man, I'm getting choked up again. I got some more information about this director, Daniel Haller, from Turner Classic Movies, who has had an article on the film online. It says, by 1965, American International Pictures had already established Edgar Allan Poe as a reputable box office name thanks to Roger Corman's string of stylish, surprisingly ambitious adaptations, beginning with 1960's The Fall of the House of Usher. You know what I always say, when you see that title on the screen, American International Pictures, you know it's going to be a movie.
It's going to be a movie.
It's definitely going to be a movie. One of the most notable talents, this is also from the article, one of the most notable talents behind these films was gifted production designer and art director Daniel Haller, a visual magician at ringing atmosphere from such simple devices as velvet curtains and dripping red candles. As the Poe films became more psychedelic and outrageous, Corman decided to take an unofficial stab at Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, which was then camouflaged as a Poe title, The Haunted Palace, that was from 1963.
Yeah.
The ruse worked well enough to give Rhode Island's most famous scribe his official due with this film, and Haller was given the opportunity to make his directorial debut, so this was his first movie, with what was obviously very tricky material. Lovecraft's track record on film has been notoriously problematic, and while Die, Monster, Die is no exception, it represents a noble attempt all the same. Haller's visual flair is evident throughout the usual cost-saving, far-out visual tricks involving swirling paint and chromatic lighting, and despite being confined in a wheelchair, Karloff still gives a committed performance.
Hmm.
I'd agree with all that. I like the visual effects, like in the opening credits.
And it looked good. I mean, all the sets were really cool and creepy, and yeah, that stuff was very impressive.
I liked the music a lot throughout as well. The music was by Don Banks. I thought it was effective.
So the movie was written by Jerry Scholl, who also wrote a lot of TV, most notably 3 episodes of Star Trek, the original series.
Oh.
Yeah, that's right. This Side of Paradise, one of my favorite episodes. But DC Fontana actually jumped in and made that episode good.
Did she get the credit or did he get the credit?
I think it was based on a story. I think he got a story credit for it and she wrote this teleplay.
I see.
Die Monster Die was shot in February and March of 1965 at the Shepperton Studios under the working title The House at the End of the World.
Yet another title for this. And I wonder why nobody considered the title The Color Out of Space.
I guess the color is just not something that scary.
You want the monster of terror.
You sure do.
Okay, well, let's get into this movie.
The movie begins with Steven Reinhardt, who is played by Nick Adams. Steven is an American arriving by steam train on a town called Arkham.
And this actor, Nick Adams, he had a small part in Rebel Without a Cause, actually. He was Chick in that movie.
Oh.
And in reality was really good buddies with James Dean, as well as Elvis Presley.
Oh, wow.
Those guys all partied with him, and he died of a prescription drug overdose, actually, a few years after this movie came out.
Oh.
And it's one of those much speculated on deaths of the period. You know, some people think it was a suicide, some a simple overdose. Some people think he was murdered, perhaps. Oh, wow. So it's one of those, you know, Hollywood mysteries.
He was actually nominated for an Academy Award for the movie Twilight of Honor in 1963. Okay. He was also in Godzilla versus Monster Zero.
Wow, that's an impressive credit.
Yeah.
Godzilla versus Monster Zero.
I loved it.
There you go. Well, his character of Reinhardt arrives in Arkham. There's a sign right there at the station that says Arkham, which is for some reason just cool that this was happening in 1965.
Yeah.
Although this Arkham is in England, obviously being true to the stories was not on anybody's mind at this point.
No.
They could set it wherever they wanted to. But I thought, well, maybe this is the original Arkham that the Massachusetts Arkham was named after.
Could be.
I can find a way to make it work.
This was actually shot in Surrey at the Baynards Railway. Now, by 1965, steam railways weren't used practically. Diesel took over steam, but a lot of these old railways were opening up for tourists to ride steam trains.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of those.
Oh, I see.
When I saw that this guy was on a steam train, I thought, okay, cool, this is a period piece, but he's dressed all 1960s.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well then, I guess it's not period piece. They just thought it would be cool to have a steam train. So he gets to town and he's looking for a ride to the Whitley place. No one will help him and they all treat him with much disdain.
It's very typical superstitious townspeople stuff. You know, nobody will give him a ride to the place. They won't even rent him a bicycle. There's a whole scene where the bike rental guy is like, no, which was somewhat interesting to me. You know, you say he's dressed all 60s, but none of the townspeople are really. They're sort of trapped in a universal horror film.
Well,
you know, or some old English provincial. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of like the Marvel Tomb of Dracula comics, because the main characters who are young and hip and cool are always dressed of the period. And then everybody else, for some reason, is trapped in these old Universal films a little bit.
Yeah, peasant clothes.
Yeah, peasant clothes, exactly.
As he walks to the house, Stephen comes across a blasted heath, and he picks off a tree branch, and it crumbles in his hands.
I thought that the blasted heath looked really cool, actually.
Yeah. He finally arrives at the house, and it's a creepy old manor with lots of warning signs and bear traps.
Yeah.
A dark shape watches from the shadows.
That cracked me up. It's already creepy. There's fog everywhere. Hard to get there. You got to walk. A whole bunch of people say, don't go up there yet. There's still signs that say, keep out. You know, it's just overkill. And the bear trap, man.
Yeah.
Nobody wants you around if there's a bear trap out.
No.
I got really scared at that moment because I don't know if you know that. I've always been scared of bear traps. It's right up there with witches and ghosts. Just, I'm horrified of bear traps. Put that in a movie and, you know, you got me.
Wow. Okay. I got to remember that one. So Reinhardt knocks on the door, but there's no answer. So he walks in. It's a super fancy but creepy looking old place. He finds an old man sitting in a wheelchair. It's Nam Whitley, who's, of course, played by Boris Karloff. Nam wants him gone. But Reinhardt says, hey, look, I was invited by Mrs. Whitley. And he shows him a letter to prove it.
Yeah, and also he avoided the bear trap, so I think if somebody avoids a bear trap to get into your mansion, you have to let them stay.
Yeah.
It's just common courtesy.
There is also a creepy butler hanging around called Merwin.
The butler kind of reminded me of Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones, the drummer. I mean, Charlie Watts now.
Oh, okay, yeah, I could see that.
Or at least somebody who roadies for the Stones. He just kind of had that vibe about him.
Nam says that his daughter, Susan, has mentioned him. Susan went to school in America, and she met Reinhardt there.
That little interchange is the best bit of dialogue in the movie for me. Mm-hmm. It's Reinhardt, his first name is Steve. He says, "Oh, me and Susan, we were in science class together." It's just very specific. And Karloff says, "Science." It's a super weird interaction because, A, it's a really weak relationship that they've set up here. Science class. You know, even if they'd said we were boyfriend and girlfriend in college, something that just would strengthen it so that he'd come all the way out here to see Susan.
Right.
Being just like her lab partner doesn't seem like as justification enough for me. And then the second thing is it sets up that for some reason Karloff hates science. But I don't know if he really does. I mean, it does tie in. There's a theme going on here.
Yeah,
sort of revealed at the end. But I don't think it's because he doesn't like science.
And Steve needs to, you know, have some scientific explanation for things that happened earlier. So that's kind of laying some groundwork for him to be spouting out from pseudoscientific stuff later.
Definitely. It shows that he's got a science background. I mean, make him a scientist then. You know, it was just odd.
Science class?
We've got all this gothic atmosphere and everything. He's like, oh, yeah, we met in science class. It just sounded it was out of place. It was funny to me.
Nam really wants Reinhardt to leave, but then Susan shows up. You can tell that they're really into each other, more than just friends, obviously. And she's played by Susan Farmer. I guess Susan was named after the actress, or maybe Susan Farmer was just destined to play Susan. I don't know.
I don't know.
But she was in Dracula, Prince of Darkness in 1966 with Christopher Lee.
And she's complete Marilyn Munster in this movie. Like, everything else, as I said, is uber goth, and then she just pops up. She's all 60s teenager. Golly gee, Steve, it's nice to see ya.
Yeah.
She's been up listening to records and having colas in some room up there. This totally doesn't... It seems oblivious to her surroundings.
Insists that he come up and meet her mother. She takes him upstairs, looking at portraits of guys that look like Boris Karloff. She says that they are her great-grandfather and then her grandfather. And he goes, oh, what's up with this guy? And she just goes, he went insane. I guess that is the most interesting fact about the guy, probably.
Yeah. If someone goes insane, you're not going to be like, oh, he enjoyed watching game shows. You're going to talk about the insanity.
But if it's your family member, if it's your grandfather, I think you would kind of keep that in your back pocket. You wouldn't just throw that out right away, first thing.
This moment kind of surprised me because we have the exact same beat in The Ward.
Oh, right.
My character shows a painting of Andrew Lehman to Connie, who's the G. Willikers Marilyn Munster type.
Yeah,
and
you
know, I never saw this movie, but it just shows that we're all trafficking in these same gothic tropes.
Oh, yeah.
But the some of the dialogue was even the same. I was like, whoa.
We can't escape it. So they go into her mother's room. It's dark, and her mother is in a bed with those drapes around it, you know, like the kind of box bed with the curtains, but you can sort of see through them a bit, but we can't really make out Mrs. Whitley. She asks to speak to Stephen alone, and so Susan leaves, and she tells him that she needs him to take Susan away from this place.
My daughter tells me you're an excellent lab partner, so I trust you with her fate forever. Take her away from this place.
Well, man, I just think things are so bad here that she's like, you know what? It can't be worse.
Anybody than that,
what's going on here. Meanwhile, Nam and the butler go into the cellar, but Merwin almost faints, and Nam checks on him to make sure he's okay.
Yeah, Nam also has an encounter with a scary spider while they're down there.
Yeah.
And I was super confused because I thought, why is Nam exploring his own weird basement as if he's unfamiliar with it?
Weird.
But I guess this was his father's arcane basement research realm.
Yeah.
Maybe he wasn't really allowed down there. Mm-hmm. And they also show some light shining. This is this is the first time you get an indication that they've got this meteor down there.
Yeah,
because they show some light shining out from a box. And
they also have a sound effect, kind of a throbbing, like a
right, exactly,
going on there.
Yeah.
So Mrs. Whitley, Letitia is her name, has Stephen Reinhardt open a box, and it has a golden earring in it. She explains that the earring was her maid's, and then she got ill like Letitia is now, and she begs him again to take Susan away.
The maid is Helga. Whom I believe was the shape that was stalking around outside.
Yes.
Not to be confused with Thora, who is the Swedish maid in the moon pool. Again, these tropes are hard to escape, having that superstitious Norwegian around.
So Nam and Merwin chain up the entrance to the greenhouse. Now Stephen comes back to see Susan asking, you know, what her mother wanted, and he tells her that he has her mother's blessing.
Right, but Susan doesn't want to go away.
He asks what's up with her mom, and she says that her dad has been taking care of her. No doctor has seen her. So Nam goes and talks with his wife. Letitia talks about the evils of his grandfather that is in him, and he says, oh, it's all nonsense. But if there is any evidence of corruption, it's in her. And he says that what happened to his father will not happen to him. And Letitia says that his grandfather was calling on the forces of darkness when he died and that they are still in the house.
I thought this was convoluted.
Yes, it sure was.
Even though we saw the paintings of these elders,
right?
Why not just make this Karloff's mistake?
Yeah.
Simplify it. He's the one who called down the forces of darkness because he was trying to do research into stuff he shouldn't have, and now they're getting punished for it. Boom. Instead of this off-screen father.
Man, they make it really convoluted. It's his grandfather that initially brings down the evil, and his father got roped into it as well, and then so he's following in this tradition of it. So they add two extra dudes that don't even need to be there at all.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like starting with young Frankenstein and not doing Frankenstein at all, you know? Just it should have just been Karloff's issue. That would have made him a much stronger character.
At a very frosty dinner with Steve and Susan and Nom, Merwin is serving food.
Yeah, they cut to this dinner scene and they are eating the most miserable meal of soup I've ever seen. It was like Wuthering Heights all over again.
They hear some strange scream kind of sound in the house somewhere, and Steven asks, you know, what the hell was that?
And I would say the sound design is genuinely creepy at times in this movie. The offstage screams are pretty chilling.
And just then, Merwin has an episode and he collapses. Nom says that happens all the time and he can take care of it, and he just basically kicks Susan and Steven out. So Susan takes some food up to her mother, and Steven has a nosy around. He finds an old book with a name Corbin Whitley on it. That's Nom's father. And the book is called Cult of the Outer Ones. Inside it says, in a very large font, cursed is the ground where the dark forces live, new and strangely bodied. He who tampers there will be destroyed. I mean, really, all those words that I just said took up a whole page. I'm guessing Corbin had a hard time seeing.
That so many people had been destroyed by tampering with it that the company that produces the Cult of the Outer Ones just had to make that warning as big as possible.
That makes sense.
Well, it was cool to get a little of that Lovecrafty stuff in there, though.
Yeah, Outer Ones, that's good.
Yeah, I would have guessed that something from this period would have gone heavy on the outer space element, the fact that it was just a meteor that was poisoning everybody. But they kind of make it a mythos plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's retribution for calling on these outer forces.
Susan is in her room and she sees a creepy black humanoid form in the window and she screams and Steven runs in. The form is gone. She feels there is something wrong with the house and that Steven suggests maybe they leave tonight, but Susan, she won't leave her mother behind. Susan sees the figure again, but it's gone when Steven looks.
And it's just a backlit person in a robe, basically. But I think it's pretty effective.
Yeah.
I thought that was probably the scariest image in the movie because the way the monsters act later is very typical, you know, mummy, Frankenstein.
Sure.
Just marching, not scary at all. But the thing moving around out in the night was pretty cool.
She feels like she's losing her mind, so Steve makes out with her.
Well, that's how it works. You know? There's two schools of thought in a movie. When somebody's freaking out, you can slap them.
Sure.
Which happens about 80% of the time.
Yeah.
The other 20%, it's solved with a quick makeout.
Sure.
And, Steve's a lover, not a fighter.
So they hear another cry and go downstairs to Merwin's room. Nom is inside, and he says that Merwin is dead. Steven wants to come in, but Nom won't let him. Susan goes to her room, but Steven goes to spy on Nom and sees that he's rolling the body of Merwin out into the greenhouse.
Not a lot is made of that, though.
Yeah.
If you were staying somewhere and somebody passed out and the guy's like, we're not calling a doctor, I'll take care of it. And then a few minutes later, you go to check on him. Oh, he died. Don't worry, I'm going to take care of it. This doesn't sound right.
Yeah, you maybe start figuring out why people said you shouldn't go to that house.
Yeah, don't go up there.
Steven soups around Merwin's room and he sees the shape of a burned body on the floor. And he sees Whitley outside, now digging a grave. Steven tries to check out the greenhouse, but of course it's locked, and he can see a green glow coming from inside.
Nom's pretty mobile for being in a wheelchair, by the way.
I mean, yeah.
Earlier, the servant was pushing him around, but sometimes, you know, once the servant was dead, didn't matter. He was popping around all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's shown a couple times moving around, so he doesn't always need the wheelchair. He's just not...
Right.
He's not wheelchair bound. He's just a bit infirmed, I think, is the...
Yeah.
So then Nom comes back, and Steven runs back into the house and pretends to be asleep, which made me laugh so hard.
Me too, like it's Ferris Bueller or something. A dude just died in the house. You were watching him bury the body. And you're like, oop, don't want to get busted. Jumps into bed with his shoes on and everything. I'm sleeping here.
So after the sun rises, Steven goes back outside and is attacked by the black hooded figure that we saw earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The figure, we see their face and it's all messed up. He fights it and then it runs off.
He quote unquote fights it.
So Stephen leaves the grounds and tracks down a doctor, this guy Henderson, who's drinking at like 7 in the morning.
Yep.
Stephen asks him about the Whitleys and he won't say anything. But his assistant or his wife, I don't know who she is, she fills Stephen in on some of the stuff, saying that Dr. Henderson was a good doctor until he went to the Whitley house. When he came back, he was half the man that he was before. It was when Corbin Whitley had died. There was no autopsy and no one knows exactly what happened to the body. Susan checks on her mother, but she doesn't answer. Susan leaves and we see Letitia's room is in shambles. Now, Stephen and Susan go outside and he tells her about the greenhouse and the glow and she's very confused by all this. And he tells her that he thinks that he was attacked by the old maid, Helga, who Letitia said was missing. Susan shows him how to sneak inside the greenhouse to get past the lock.
Yeah, they're going to sneak in there and I don't know. Why is Susan so confused about everything?
Yeah, I guess she had blinders on with all this stuff. Or she was off way at college and it wasn't happening until she was gone.
Her character is such a nitwit.
She's a nitwit. Nam tries Letitia's room, but she won't answer. We see that she's cowering in the corner and her face is all messed up.
This movie is so repetitive. You know, it's one of those just people walking around a house for a long time before you get to the climax. But yes. It's so repetitive that it almost feels hallucinatory at times.
Yeah.
I'm watching it and going, wait, did I rewind it accidentally or is there a mistake in the film? It really started to feel weird to me.
So Steve and Susan go into the greenhouse and they see all these giant vegetables and flowers.
Reference to the story, which I thought was cool.
Yeah. I was like, wow, there's actually something from the story in here. They follow this droning sound and they hear a shriek and they go into this dark room and it's a room full of weird creatures in cages.
I thought that was genuinely creepy.
Yeah.
You don't get a good glimpse of them, but they've got, they look sort of Lovecraftian.
Yeah.
Steve calls it a zoo from hell. Are they, or were they people? Or
I don't,
are they animal mutations?
They're so weird looking that you can't really tell what the heck they were or are. It's just creepy. It's good.
It's good. And they don't spend a lot of time either in there.
No.
They just kind of give you a glimpse and then get out, which is smart.
They leave and find rocks in pots with the plants in the greenhouse. And he thinks they're radioactive. The rock is mutating the plants and animals. I don't know why he's holding it with his bare hands.
Exactly.
Since it's radioactive.
He seems to know a lot about it, but he's still completely, he doesn't think, let's get out of here or maybe we shouldn't be getting irradiated. Yeah, you know, it's like you and I are too normal to be affected by radiation.
I mean, he says it's warm to the touch. Like,
yeah.
So Stephen thinks these radioactive rocks are affecting the whole family, and he says they have to leave. Susan says Helga, the old maid, and her mother used to work in the greenhouse, so that explains why they were affected.
Right.
Susan is attacked by the plants. You know, it's the whole vines reach out and grab her, and Stephen has to hack her out, and he kicks the door open to escape.
There's a slow wind-up to the branches attacking.
Oh, right.
Stephen doesn't see it at all for some reason, but he's standing across from Susan watching, you know, listening to her talk, and there's a hilarious beat where a vine tries to grab her, but she steps forward just and the vine misses.
Yeah.
It was like a little slapstick for the plant audience.
So Stephen suspects that there's more rocks, maybe a big rock that all the other little rocks came from in the cellar of the house. So he goes down while Susan goes to her room. Stephen is attacked by bats.
Yes.
And then he discovers the big stone that is glowing and pulsing.
He gets attacked by bats and a skeleton.
Well,
not attacked, but surprised by
the
skeleton.
Yeah, he's surprised by the skeleton.
That's for some reason hanging right behind some doors and swings out at him.
Where else are you going to hang that skeleton? So Nam comes down and he gets all into Steven's face about messing around in his business, but Steven just shuts him down. He doesn't care what he says. Just then they hear Susan scream and they run up to find her on the floor. Letitia is running around acting all violent and she's all messed up looking as well. As she attacks Steven and he brains her with a candle holder.
Yeah.
She dies and then she melts. And Nam tells Steven to get Susan out of there.
What did you think of the makeup effects?
You know, they weren't bad. You know, they're very 60s for the time, but they're gross. I thought it was really disgusting.
There's no real aesthetic. It's just shapeless flesh. You know, the cheapness of it kind of makes it creepier than...
Yeah.
And it's bloody, too.
Yeah.
What did you think about the methods of attack in that scene? Were you... Steve's just throwing things on the ground to trip up the mother.
The fights in these old movies, I remember, are always really just kind of haphazard. They have a kind of a more realistic quality to them where they're not as choreographed. They just are people scrambling about, which I think real fights are more like that.
Well, I suppose, but it's also, you know, she's lurking towards him and he's just backing up slowly.
Oh, well, yeah, that stuff is
throws a chair down on the ground. And then, you know, the thing, I think the mother actually comes in and just collapses. So it's easy to brain her, you know, so she wasn't really that strong to begin with.
No.
So it's a little, it's more pathetic than scary.
So Stephen and Nam are hanging out in the cemetery. I don't know why. And maybe they're doing their last respects to his wife because she just turned into dust on the floor. I don't know. Maybe they scooped her up and buried her. I don't know. But they're standing in the cemetery like they're over somebody's grave or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then we finally get some exposition. It seems that an asteroid landed in the blasted heath during the time of Corbin. Corbin took it into the house and it made all these awesome fruits and flowers. And he was hoping to return honor to the family and prosperity because his father was a guy that was trafficking with demons and
sure.
otherworldly forces. But of course, this thing just drove him mad. So Susan, she shows up and she doesn't want to leave her father behind, but he insists.
You're making things worse for me because I thought it was Karloff who really had the plan. It was like, I want to use this meteor to make all this great stuff to restore the family name.
No.
But so he really doesn't have much purpose at all.
No.
Yeah, I thought that was going to be, that was Karloff's tragic flaw. He thought of using it for selfish purposes instead of getting researchers in there.
So they go to pack and Nom gets an axe and he's going to break up the big stone. Helga comes in with an axe and attacks Nom, but he defends himself with his axe. She misses and hits the stone.
There's only one thing that can destroy this meteorite, and it's an axe. It's kind of lame, but it's also funny. There's just axes laying around everywhere in this place.
Well, that's, you know, in old manor houses, that's what you do. You just put axes everywhere. Mm. So Nom is infected by the stone, and he starts to glow green. And he becomes this really, you know, like there's this whole transformation scene where his like little veins and stuff grow out and plants and things.
Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Steven hears the scream, and he runs down to check on him. He sees all these glowing handprints around and he follows them.
Then, I liked that too. That was
cool. That was cool, yeah. And then Nom, now this glowing monster guy, he's got smooth, shiny, glowing, and humming skin. He's still in his suit, but he's like, he kind of looks like the Silver Surfer.
No, man, he looks like Destro. That's immediately what I thought. He's like, it's the way that they're exposing it too. It's got this kind of sheen to it as if you're looking at it through blurry eyes.
And right.
It gives it this disco feel. He's like Disco Destro Karloff at that moment. It's the least horrifying thing I've ever seen. I just want to hit the club with him.
He goes right after Steven, and Steven tries to fight him with an axe to keep Shiny Nom from hurting Susan, but he falls over the balcony, and then he just catches fire.
Yeah, he lunges for Susan. She dodges out of the way. So I just want to point out that she's the one that saved the day. Steven's axe attacks were pathetic.
Yeah.
Falls over the balcony. He just sort of turns into fireworks. I think they just let a bunch of fireworks off and film
that.
Yeah,
I don't know what that's... I guess the energy of the stone that went in him escaped when he hit the floor. I don't know. So the whole house starts to go up in flames, and Susan and Steven escape as the house burns into the ground.
It was yet another girl with amazing hair escaping from a foreboding mansion. It's that great gothic image. I think maybe it was when he blew up and turned into fire. It was like he was a disco inferno, disco destro inferno. That's the only way a disco monster can go out, setting the dance floor on fire.
It ends with Steven saying that Nom's scientific discovery in the right hands could have helped mankind, but instead he used it to try and give his family honor.
So that is, I guess, his tragic flaw.
Yeah.
Even if it was his father's idea initially, he's still doing the same thing, trying to improve the family name because nobody in the town likes them. So the meteor is going to somehow do it. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess.
He didn't try to play God. He was just concerned about selfish things. They always got to drive home some kind of message at the end of these movies.
Yeah.
And that was it. So what were your thoughts overall on this film?
Oh, it was really boring.
Yeah, it's blissfully short. It's like an hour and 15 minutes long.
Yeah, I think hour and 13. It's really short.
If it had been longer, it would have definitely broken me because it was really boring. And my capacity to watch boring stuff is not as good as it used to be.
No way.
I fell asleep.
Not when Game of Thrones is on.
Yeah, exactly.
When that's going on in my life right now, and then you have me watch this thing, it's like, Jesus, come on.
You gotta go into a lower gear. Well, I started watching it, fell asleep, and then set it for a later time when I was more alert to watch it. But thankfully, I knew what it was going in the next time, and so I was able to kind of put the brakes on my antsiness.
The thing that got me through it was actually like looking at the sets and the locations and looking at all the detail. Like I found myself looking at the backgrounds a lot and going, "Oh well, look at that! That candle holder over there is really cool, or that tapestry there is really neat." And, you know, seriously, I found it really interesting, and they were really cool sets.
Yeah, no, definitely that stuff was great. It was finding out that it was directed by a set designer makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he really showed off that set, and he did a really good job of doing that.
But for being only one of the first couple of Lovecraft adaptations, I got to say I was happy. I mean, it didn't really adhere to the story, but it was a little more Lovecrafty than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, they had the book and they made reference to the Outer Ones and, you know, they didn't want to lose the audience, so they don't go too down the path with that. But instead of making it Satan or something, they did stick with it being others, you know, mythological entities.
Yeah, and they had a blasted heath. They had the giant fruit. They had the twisted animals.
Yeah.
You know, so they kept a lot of the themes in there. It was just the execution of it was so poor and slow.
Right. And I could have used more dialogue from Karloff as well.
Yeah, that's it. I'm like, you got Boris Karloff in your movie, and I'm bored.
I know.
What did you do wrong?
Well, there was what happens in a lot of these movies, there was a lot of name play, you know, where it's like the second half of Titanic. I think the script just said Jack Rose, Jack Rose, Jack Rose. You know, this was like
Right, yeah.
Oh, Steve, yeah. Steve, what do we do? Susan, go over there, Susan. And then they'd cut away to Karloff, who'd just be going, Letitia, Letitia. And then they'd cut back, oh, Steve, what is it, Steve? I mean, just a lot of proper names being thrown around rather than, you know, I want to hear some crazy speeches or
talk about the other ones, the outer gods and all that. Just get it. I want a good villain monologue in there somewhere.
Something like that, yeah.
But no, we didn't get that. Anyway, I'm still glad we watched it, and I feel good that now that's part of who I am.
Well, I do actually like talking about these films on an individual basis. Like I said at the beginning, you know, we've covered these sorts of movies overall or when we're discussing stories on the show, but it was kind of nice just to drill into one and chat about it, and hopefully our listeners are into that kind of thing as well.
Yeah,
I know that we don't have a lot of Lovecraft content anymore, sort of indirectly, but here we are talking about The Color Out of Space again, so hopefully that's the kind of thing that folks are into.
Yeah.
If not, let us know. But we're very grateful to have you all as part of the team. And I think that's all we have for this week. Yeah.
That's it. With that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. Bonus content.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.